What do private equity firms want from MSPs? Managed services sales might be easier than you think. And if Goldilocks was an MSP, how would she price her managed services? Coming up next.
You are entering the MSP Zone, a podcast for the managed services community, covering news, analysis, and interviews from around the globe. Elevate your MSP game by staying in the MSP Zone. And now, your host, Charles Weaver.
Okay, I know everyone's watching and tuning in just for the Goldilocks MSP parable. We're going to leave that one to the end because that's a really good one. And it's actually based on Goldilocks isn't based on a real story, but we had a recent interaction with a member who had some very real pricing questions. Very common topic here at MSP Alliance, but we're going to talk about that and apply the Goldilocks principle of getting your pricing just right so it just works. So stay tuned for the end for that one. But first, private equity firms, MSP acquisition, what do you need to know? What's important? That's what we're talking about first. This topic came up because I get, again, almost every day, private equity people who are saying, hey, you want to read our reports, we want to hear what's going on in the MSP sector, but here's what we want to do. And so it's always about finding a match between private equity group and the MSP community. And that's been going on for a long time, and it continues to grow. And that's a good thing because we want more PE, private equity activity in the MSP sector globally. So I'm gonna kind of break down the distinction between a PE buyer and a everybody else type of buyer, right? Typically another MSP buyer, right? An MSP buying an MSP versus a private equity firm buying an MSP, which are not at all the same thing. They can be, but typically they're very different. And a lot of you have never been through a transaction involving a private equity firm, and it's quite different in many ways than dealing with another MSP buyer for a variety of reasons. Number one, when you're dealing with another MSP owner operator, there is an assumption and probably a realistic one that the MSP buyer has a lot of knowledge about what you do, more so than the average PE firm. Why? Because they're an MSP owner and operator. They run an MSP business. They understand that profession very well, probably as well as you do. So there's already a common level of knowledge, awareness of what you do as an MSP. And so they're already read in and at an advanced level compared to private equity firms. And again, it's not saying that the PE firms are not smart. They're smart people, they're smart groups, but they are smart in areas related to typically finance and investment, not necessarily, infrequently, in my opinion, and experience, not proficient in managed services necessarily, in the operations, that is. And so there are many reasons. We've talked about them before, about why M&A activity is taking place, that it's not consolidation, it's not lack of demand, dealing with underperforming MSP assets. It could be just driving growth for a particular thing. Generally speaking, the really good, healthy M&A transactions involving MSP to MSP deals are expansion, not growth via acquisition, but traditional expansion through services, through geography, through a customer vertical. Any number of those areas represent, in my opinion, really healthy motives for doing an M&A deal. Okay. There are other motives. We've talked about them over the last 3 years. For a buyer, an investor to invest in an MSP business, what might those be? Well, same reason why anyone invests in anything. You want to see a return on investment, ROI. You want to get something back in exchange for you having invested in that thing. if that thing is an MSP organization, at some point you're going to want to get your money out. Now, that is a very different concept and a very different timetable for an MSP buyer. I don't want to get too much into that right now, but just take my word for it that MSP buyers have a different timetable. Their schedule of what they want to do, especially if they're a buyer who is looking at has a very long-term vision for themselves and their MSP business, they may say, look, we want to be in this for a decade or two decades, or we want to grow it for a long time. A PE firm is going to have a much different, much shorter ROI schedule that you need to be aware of before you really start to think about, is a PE firm deal in my best interest? You may be saying, well, what does it matter? I'm not going to be with the company anyway. Well, maybe, maybe not. And we'll get to that in a moment. Let's first talk about how do PE firms traditionally like to structure their deals. I'm being very generic here because I know different PE firms have very different, kind of boutique areas. Some are mid-market, some are, early stage, SMB. Some like to have very specific, almost rigid guidelines, financial guidelines for what type of deals they will or will not do. So I'm going to be somewhat generic in this, but I think it largely is going to be accurate. Most of the PE firms today are wanting to get a piece of they're trying to ride the lightning, right? The cybersecurity-driven managed services lightning bolt, which we've been seeing for better part of 5+ years. And that is simply that MSPs represent just an overall really good business investment across the board in most sectors of the world. It's recurring revenue. They're generally good margin, sticky customer relationships, high growth, relatively recession resistant, and many other things, all good things that check the box of a private equity fund manager saying, where do we put our money in an era where there's high stock volatility? The equities markets are just going up and down, up and down. Inflation, at least in recent years, has been a fairly big problem. You have runs on banks, you have bank closures. You've got a lot of uncertainty out there. And when any investor can put their money into a fund managed by a private equity group, and they say, hey, we've got a really good feeling about MSPs, let's put some of our money there, you could see the appeal. An investor would say, yeah, that's a really good ROI. Let's do that. So what does that look like? Well, a private equity firm isn't traditionally going to buy out 100% of the company for a couple of reasons. Number one, they're going to want to have a little bit of margin to play with in order to do two things, in my opinion. Number one, they want to keep you, the business owner, and or operator, if you are critical to the ongoing success of the company. And at least for a short period of time, they're going to definitely want you around for transition. But if you're an owner-operator and you are in some way integrally involved with running that business, and assuming, let's say it's the CEO, right? You're the CEO of your MSP, private equity firm comes in, says, we don't have another MSP CEO to replace you with. Would you be willing to stay? And maybe you are. Maybe you're young enough that you say, I got another decade or more in me. Let's do this. And then they would say, well, let's take some of this equity and let's roll this over into NewCo, right? Whatever they're going to call that, the new company MSP. And they'll give you a percentage. Now, it'll most likely be much smaller than what you own today, maybe. But that's why they want some margin, right? They're not going to buy 100% of the company. They're going to maybe buy up to 90%. Maybe they'll buy 50%. Maybe they'll buy 75%. They're going to keep a little bit around to do things like that. They may also want to give equity to a new group of executives that they know are going to be necessary to achieve growth in the NewCo MSP. What would that be, you might ask? Well, let's say you're a CEO, owner, operator. They want to keep you. You have really good relationships with your customers, but you don't have a CTO. You don't have a VP of sales. Maybe you don't have a VP of finance. There's some things missing that they, the PE firm, would say, hey, we really like what you've been doing so far, but we want to go further. And you're going to need these things to achieve that growth. We're going to take 10, 15, 20% and hold it back or carve it out. And we're going to give this to a different group of executives who are going to come in, and you as the CEO, or you're going to manage them and achieve that growth goal. That would be another reason why they would hold back. It's not a traditional hold back. What they're doing is carving out a certain percentage of equity that they could play around with and dole it out to different people to entice them to come on board, plus a salary, and get them to be fully invested and on board this journey forward. Make sense? All right. Next thing, unlike the MSP buyer, the private equity firm is going to have a much shorter runway or hold time, right? They're going to want to hold this asset. Every time you think of a PE firm and their acquisition of an MSP, how they think of it as an asset, as an invested asset. They want to get an ROI return. They want it sooner rather than later, but many of them are willing to be patient and say, I'm going to play this out over a period of time. But at the end of this time period, I'm going to want to start thinking about cashing out. We'll talk about that moment. And I'm going to get my money back. I'm going to get my money back for my investors. Remember, it's not just one person. This is typically a fund. This is a group, a pool of investors who have put their money into a PE firm, said to the PE firm, go make us money. That's what the PE firm's doing. So when they buy an MSP and they make these kind of organizational changes, in their opinion, to get growth, what they're saying is, hey, I want at a fixed time, and it's not exactly like on this date, on this year, we're going to sell, we're going to have a liquidity event. It's not that prescribed. It's more like, hey, we're going to hold this investment for three years, maybe 5 years. I wouldn't say that's going to be larger than 10 years. I think I think anything approaching 10 years would probably be fairly long. In my experience, PE firms like to have an investment on average around 3 to 5 years. I think that's a fairly, in my experience, typical hold time. All right. That's the period of time that the PE firm is going to be an invested equity owner in the company, with a board seat, right? They're going to want to have voting rights, and they're going to want to have a say, even if you are the CEO in that example, and they've brought in other executives to help the growth strategy become execution. They're going to want to say, look, we'll give you 3 years, we'll give you four, we'll give you 5 years, but these are the things we want you to accomplish in each one of these years. And when we get to year three, four, or five, we are then going to pivot to a liquidity event. What's a liquidity event? No, it doesn't mean rain. It means you're cashing out. The company, the MSP NewCo company, is cashing out some of its equity holders and refreshing or replacing some of them. Now, that could be the PE firm group only. Now, maybe they took 60%. And the remaining 40% is you and some of the other new executives. Well, they might say, hey, in 5 years, we want to take our 60% and replace it. So we're going to propose we move forward with an acquisition where we find a new PE firm. Maybe they go to another PE firm and say, hey, we have 60% of company of NewCo company MSP over here. Do you want to buy it? Because now, you may be thinking, why would one PE firm sell to another PE firm? Well, they make money that way. They all know each other, or they seem to know each other. And so you may have one PE firm that is very specialized and comfortable in certain revenue bands. Maybe the MSP that they've purchased is in the $5 million bracket, and their goal is to get it to $10 million in that 3 to 5 year plan. And then they go to their buddies over at PE firm, you know, XYZ, and that PE firm really specializes in taking $10 million MSP companies and taking them up to 50. Now, before you're asking, I'll tell you, because I know some of you are out there saying, well, why would they do that? Trust me, they have areas where they feel comfortable. They have mission plans for their assets that they have comfort in. And there are some that are just, you know, very comfortable in the 5 to 10 million or 3 to 10 million dollar range, and others that are very, very comfortable at the 10 to 50 million dollar range, and so on and so on. And there are different segments, different PE firms that have really different specializations and different capabilities to be able to take invested assets, MSP assets, and make them profitable to the point where they can bring their investors a nice, healthy return on that investment. And so if you are, now why am I telling you this now in mid-2023? Well, for a couple of reasons, because if you've been reading the, you know, Wall Street or financial sector news, you might have seen that, you know, IPOs, initial public offerings, have been somewhat tamped down, right? There's not a lot of them taking place for a variety of reasons. Don't want to get into that. And so you might say, well, if there's no companies going public, you know, we've got a lot of examples of companies who are public going private. Isn't that going to be bad for the PE community investing in MSPs? Not necessarily. The liquidity, the tightening credit markets, again, stuff that we've been talking to you guys about for a while, is real. But it actually has had a unique impact on some of these private equity firms, because think about it. If you are an institutional professional investor and you are moving your money out of the equities markets, you're not putting it under a mattress. Contrary to popular opinion, you're not just putting it into a bucket, burying the bucket in the ground and putting it there until the banks become, you know, healthy again. Doesn't happen that way. A lot of them are taking their money out of the markets and saying, well, let's put a healthy percentage of it with the PE firm or the venture capital community, and let's get them to generate a return on investment just like we would if we owned a public stock. Make sense? That's why there is that type of movement from the equities markets to the private equity community. And specifically at the lower end, the lower range, you will typically find, because think about it, even with historically over the last year, although it's started to come down a little bit, we've had for over a year fairly nasty inflation here and abroad. And it's been really expensive to borrow money. So the larger the deal, makes sense. It's going to be really cost inefficient for a private equity group to be able to borrow money. Now, I know that that's already your head's exploding and saying, well, wait a minute, I thought the PE firm had the money from the investors to go buy the MSPs. That's still true, but they don't always use all of their investor money. In fact, they rarely do. What they'll typically do is they'll mix it up. And I know this is maybe a TMI for some of you, but the PE firm will mix the money. They'll take a portion of the fund, the investors, we'll call it the fund, and they'll mix it with a percentage of borrowed money just to distribute the risk. And I don't exactly know all the ins and outs of it, but trust me, that's what they do. And obviously, if they're taking any commercial debt to finance an MSP deal, you know, you don't want to do it in the middle of sky-high inflation because it's going to be costly to borrow that money. So the lower the deals, typically the easier it is for the PE firm to finance, structure the financing of a MSP deal. They won't have to rely so much on commercial debt, with high interest rates, they will be able to maybe use their fund a bit more effectively and control that debt interest payment and be able to do more deals. That's why we are still seeing deals. And most of the firms that I'm seeing are saying, yeah, smaller deals are actually relatively unimpacted by the inflation and the equities markets and everything that we're seeing out there. It's still pretty good. So I wanted you guys to be aware of just this general distinction between private equity and MSP buyer. What does the private equity value? What are their goals? What's their time frame? So you can be well informed if you are being hit up by PE firms. And I'm guessing if you're an MSP CEO, you probably are getting a fair number of weekly, if not daily, phone calls and emails and, you know, every other knock on the door to try to get your attention to say, hey, would you think about selling? Would you sell to us? Sell me your MSP. So at least now you're a little bit more informed. You can make a better decision that's right for you, and hope this helped. On to the next topic. Managed services sales, was it? Yes, it was. Another recurring theme that we have been talking about, not only on the podcast here for a number of years, but at the MSP Alliance for at least 20 years. I can't think of a MSP World Conference over 20 plus years that hasn't had at least a handful of sessions that focused on sales. And I know it's important. I recognize its importance, but I also recognize that there is no consensus around sales. And I think that that's curious because you would think that there would be after that amount of time. We have consensus in many other areas of managed services practice and service operations. Believe me, I mean, we have a standard that helped to synthesize and codify those best practices into a standard. But sales is different. It's different for a number of reasons. Now, a little bit of a backstory. I've been reading recently a sales book, which I never do. In fact, this is the first sales book I've ever read. And it's not an MSP sales book. It's just a regular, I think it actually came out a couple decades ago. So it's one of those sales books that isn't like a new, you know, hey, this is how you use LinkedIn and Instagram to fuel your sales leads. No. It's a several decades old book that has been around for a while. And I don't want to tell you the book's name. If you want to, I'll tell you privately, but I don't want to say it out here because, you know, someone might get offended and say, well, why are you using that methodology, man? You could be using this one over here. This one works better for MSP. I don't want to get into all that. I want to talk about the principles in the book that we're seeing. The book essentially says, if you are taught in professional sales training, which the book asserts is the vast majority of sales training on the planet Earth, contains sales tactics and training tactics that are well suited for smaller ticket item transactions. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean price tag, but mostly it does, right? Sales tactics, if I'm selling a $250 widget or a $100 widget or something that a consumer can purchase right there within like 10, 15 minutes of deciding and thinking about it, it's not a big thing. It's not a deal breaker compared to, let's say, a $20,000 price object, right? That's not going to be a 15-minute decision. That's going to be I got to think about it. I have to get budget approval. I might have to get multiple people in my company to buy that. And there's going to be, in the case of managed services, there's an ongoing relationship with the provider, the one selling, and the buyer, the customer, right? Those two parties are going to be very closely collaborating after the sale has been concluded. So already you can see that there's really big differences between that type of a managed services sale And the smaller ticket, we'll call it a small sale, a small deal size, which is where, according to the book, most of the sales, training, and education and literature is spent around small deal sales. And after I read that, I realized, I'll be damned, that's true. I see that a lot in the MSP community. I see a lot of material that is really aimed at those types of tactics. For example, you might be thinking, what, Charles, what are you talking about? What types of tactics do you think you see in the managed services community right now? Well, now and historically, I see a lot of very weak lead gen, number one. And lead gen is more is maybe part marketing, but I see a lot of very weak lead generation programs out there. I also see a lot of emphasis on things such as closing techniques, handling objections, and other types of tactics that are traditional fodder in the sales training community, designed to sell training plans, training sales techniques, classes, books, certifications, online training, physical training, boot camps, and every other manner of training material typically involves things that deal with, among other things, hey, we're going to help you become a better closer. You're not selling managed services because you don't know how to close. If you figure out how to close in my easy five technique strategy, you'll become a 10-figure MSP or whatever. I get that a lot. Have you? Because I see it a lot. And if I see it, I'm assuming you guys see it. Maybe it's objections. You just don't know how to have your people deal with objections from the customers. And if you learn the principles of dealing with customer objections and managed services, you'll become a more profitable MSP. And so on and so on and so on. And I've always been resistant to that type of training because I've always been a believer in this one thing, which I've said from day one. For 23 years, I've said this. You can talk to people who've heard me say it because I've been fairly, not inflexible, but fairly consistent over 23 years. I haven't really deviated from this belief. And it wasn't until this year when I read this book that I realized that, unbeknownst to me, that's actually it's a legitimate thing. I just didn't know how to vocalize it. But what my belief was is that managed services sales is fundamentally different from any other type of sales. But specifically, MSP sales is different than VAR sales. Now, that is a tactic, a debate, an area of study that should be not really foreign to especially any of you MSP owners, operators, executives who have been in the industry for at least 10 years or more. You probably know this. You've probably heard what I just said before. VAR sales, product sales, selling hardware, selling software is nothing like selling managed services for a number of reasons. But the attempt to take a value-added reseller sales team, very comfortable, let's say, and proficient in selling hardware and software, they traditionally don't have a lot of success selling managed services. This is not new. We know this to be true. Why? I think the answer was in the book. The book saying you are using the wrong technique. You are using the wrong approach. You are being trained. You are spending time and resources learning techniques in sales that are applicable are applicable to low ticket, lower value, small deal types of products. And these techniques are not compatible, nor are they effective in moving managed services sales. That's the premise. that premise, if you accept it, as I do, it makes sense to me, now makes sense as to why I've instinctively said for 23 years, I don't think MSPs sell what they deliver anything close to how I see, you know, selling a server or selling a large, you know, network attached storage, you know, array or whatever, big ticket firewalls or anything like that. They're very, very different. And I was drawing from legal, medical, accounting also have the same issues, right? They do not apply traditional sales techniques in those areas for a variety of reasons. But I didn't think managed service providers would be able to apply non-professional services sales techniques with any great effect. And I don't believe that they have. Now, there are very effective managed services sales people and teams out there. But in my opinion, they have some of the following characteristics, which I would like to share with you. And these are the things that I think will be effective in developing good, productive managed services sales results. Asking questions, consultative selling. I don't even call it that because, you know, people, I know solution selling is a big thing out there, and I don't want to get hung up on the type of terminology, right? I'm trying to be descriptive of what the process is that works rather than try to get it branded or lumped into something that may already exist, right? So forget that. MSPs who I have witnessed are very comfortable in a sales situation, although they don't think that they are salespeople and they don't think that they're actually selling, are the ones who engage with a customer or prospect and start to ask questions, probing questions about what they're trying to achieve, but also what is their current IT situation like? And that is not a sales technique that a lot of MSP organizations, scratch that. That is not a technique that a lot of value-added reseller organizations have historically employed. Why? I'll tell you why. Because most of those reactive VAR organizations, who, by the way, are successful at moving product, keep that in mind. What are they selling really? They're selling someone else's product. They're selling a server. Let's call it a brand of server in this example. Are you going to have a sales process involving a server when and have the salesperson ask a bunch of questions related to the technology today? Probably not. But they're probably right. What they're not going to go to the customer and say, "Well, what type of server do you have?" They might ask that, but they're not going to start asking a bunch of holistic questions. They're going to lead with, "You wanted to talk to me about a new server. Well, you told me you have this server. Well, I can sell you this server. It's 3 years newer. It's shiny. It can do this, 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 and this." And I name all the features. And I can sell it to you at this, which is X percentage lower than my competitor. That is a fairly typical sales process for a VAR, selling a product. Big ticket item or low ticket. But the point is, it's very transactional. They're going to sell the thing and they're going to walk away. Yeah, maybe they'll provision it. Maybe they'll deliver it as a project to set it up. But that's it. That's how they would sell. But an MSP doesn't sell that way. An MSP is not going to sell features, functionality, and they're not going to tick off a box of, you know, 100 items that their managed services offering can do for you as a customer if you become a customer. What most MSPs I know do is they start talking to the customer and say, "What's your problem? What's your business problem? What are you struggling with? It's security. You're worried about security. You're worried about compliance. You're worried about getting ransomware, you're worried about losing your data. I get it. It's serious. Is anyone managing your infrastructure today?" Nobody does, huh? You just have it running, and when it breaks, you call the local computer shop, right? Okay. Well, so it's not being managed, right? That's what an MSP does, is they start to explore what's actually going on and how the IT impacts the business. And when they start to have that type of a conversation, they then start to focus not on the features, not on the things that they are in the products that they're selling. They start to talk about what they as an MSP organization can do for the customer to solve that problem that the customer divulged to the MSP through a series of questions. And it's only because, and I know you're saying, well, maybe we should just teach our VAR salespeople to learn those questions. All right, well, if we could have done that, we've done it 20 years ago. No one's done it yet. Why? Because it takes someone who's skilled and understands managed services and understands how IT generally works and understands how not to lead with the features of the widget that they are going to sell, but instead looks at the holistic service, the professional service that is being delivered from the MSP, and how that correlates to solving a problem that the customer has verbalized to the MSP. Now, if you can teach your MSP salespeople to do that, more power to you. You've solved the problem. You're one of the saved now. But the vast majority of MSPs, I think, really struggle with that concept because they think, well, that doesn't feel like a sales process. Well, maybe it's not. And I still do believe, and I would advocate, that you do have to have a sales process to follow, even if it's a simple one. But don't get yourself tricked into this mindset that you have to feel and act like a used car salesman in order to be an effective salesperson. I think that a lot of sales training and a lot of sales marketing, trying to sell sales training to MSPs, is that it's trying to convince you that you have to cloak yourself in that kind of salesperson persona and behavior. I've never believed that, and none of the MSPs that I've seen who are effective, many of them are business owners at the smaller MSP levels. Many of those chief salespeople are the CEO. And they don't call themselves necessarily professional salespeople, but they are very good at understanding the relationship they have with a customer, with a new customer, developing that relationship through helping them solve a problem, not by selling them something. I think it's that simple, folks. I really do. And again, if you want to read the book, I'd be happy to tell you the book that I'm talking about. But if it's helpful for some of you to just start to dispel this myth around managed services sales, I think that people overthink it. I think it's a lot easier. I think it's far easier than most people give it credit for. And they want to overcomplicate it, and they want to make it into something that is unattainable. And I don't think it needs to be. And I think you could be really effective, even as a small organization, even a small MSP organization could have one or two really effective sales people who are selling for the company, selling managed services for the company, and not have to have the professional training, the professional sales training that's just going to give them a bunch of ideas that are not going to be applicable to what they do and what they offer. My perspective, if you have a different opinion, I would love to hear about it. Let's finish with Goldilocks, shall we? Okay. It's not actually about Goldilocks, but this is another real world scenario where we were contacted recently by a few companies who said, you know what, I got a problem. And the problem is, I think our pricing is wrong. And so it's not an uncommon thing for us to hear. So we ask, well, what makes you think that your pricing is wrong? And the typical answer will be, well, we're losing deals because the customer said we're too high, which is common. If you are priced too high, it is not unusual for that customer to say, you know what? We really like you. We really like what you had to offer. It sounded really good, but you know what? Compared to everybody we're talking to, you're just priced too high. And a lot of customers will give you that feedback. Or price too low. Now, I've never heard an MSP say that their customer told them they were priced too low. But how would an MSP otherwise know that they were priced too low? Well, typically, low prices and managed services will manifest itself in the form of a couple of things. Low margin. Typically, it's low margin. I mean, that's the ultimate indicator that you are not priced high enough to cover what you're doing. Now, it could also be low margin doesn't necessarily mean that you're priced too low. It generally is, but not always. You could be priced fairly, but you've got a deficiency, or put differently, you have an inefficiency built into your service delivery engine, and that inefficiency is causing you to expend more resources to deliver a service that you otherwise could deliver for a fraction of the cost. That is actually a fairly common thing that we see. It's generally an overly complicated service delivery process. It is generally a poorly defined set of controls operating inefficiently. It will typically be, if you're talking about something like, for example, backup, if you're doing managed backup as a service, where we see a lot of inefficiency and therefore threats to the managed services margin, is if the MSP is servicing too many vendors. You know, like, you know, we ask them, well, can you give us an area where you think that you're priced too low or incorrectly? And they might say, well, our managed services for backup. And I say, well, tell us about what's going on. And they'll say, well, you know, how do you deliver your managed backup as a service? Well, we've got 10 different vendors that you've got 10 different vendors that you support. He goes, oh yeah. I said, why do you have 10 different vendors? Well, because our customers like to, you know, we like to please our customers. We don't like to say no to them. So when they bring a backup vendor to us and they say, hey, could you support this? Could you manage that? That's what we've done over the years. And so, you know, we've ended up with around 10 different backup vendors that we support. Right there is an inefficiency in the service delivery process that could be eliminated and make wonders in the bottom line. Sometimes it's that. Sometimes it's, like I said, a manual process that maybe they don't necessarily know. They're just doing something in an inefficient way, manually, whatever that may look like. There's too many examples to give. And that is causing, you know, too many people, too many hours involved to deliver that service. The margin is really, really low. And the executive team says, This doesn't sound very good. This managed services experiment is not working out. Well, it's not that the experiment's not working out. You're not getting it right. That there's something that's not working here, but it can be fixed. So here are some examples. All right, now I've given you some examples of what the problem is. Here are some examples of how to fix it. Okay, number one, if you think that you're too high, you could just be overshot. You could also be doing something too inefficiently in your service delivery process, but you're smart enough to realize that unless you raise your prices, you're going to have a really bad margin experience. And so I've seen a lot of MSPs who say, I know I have a really bad process, or we tell them that they have a bad process, but they actually are making money on it. And some of them are lucky enough that they can get away with it, but generally speaking, it doesn't last too long. At some point, the market is going to push back and say, you know what? I think I can get what you're delivering to me, the same value, cheaper over here. Now, I wouldn't want any MSP listening to that to say, well, we have to lower our price because we don't want to lose our customers. I'm not a fan of that at all. But you do have to know that you are efficient in your service delivery so that you can then set your price. And our rule of thumb, generally speaking, is if you're doing at least 30% gross margin in your managed services, that's where you need to be minimum. If you're below that, something's wrong. You're not priced high enough, or you've got inefficiencies. One of those two things is generally right if you're not hitting at least 30% gross profit. Now, does that mean that you can only hit or maintain 30%? That's where you should stay? No. No. I know a lot of MSPs who have 50, 60, 70% gross margin because they have learned how to become really efficient. They've learned to use automation. They have a lot of really good skilled thought that goes into the delivery process, and they spend a lot of time working on service delivery issues to drive out inefficiency. The good MSPs that I see, that's what they spend their time on. They don't spend a lot of time on, are we priced right according to the other MSPs in this region? Because the good MSPs know that they can execute better and they're comfortable in their pricing. And if they're comfortable in their service delivery execution and they're efficient to the point that I've just described, then chances are, it's a good chance, that the customer is seeing something really good that doesn't fail there that often, delivers a high quality, repeatable quality service, and they're happy with the price that they pay. And maybe they said, hey, we're going to go and look at another provider, but the provider says, hey, I can't do what this other company's doing, even for double the price, because they can't do it, right? The inefficiency might be too great. So look at the 30% gross profit margin as a good kind of waterline. If you're above it, you're good. If you're below it, something's probably wrong, and it could be a pricing indicator of you're too low. It needs to be adjusted up, or it could be, in many cases, an inefficiency in the service delivery engine, something that needs to be fixed. There's too many different variables to list all of them, but there's a lot there that could go wrong. And that would be our advice to begin to fix a pricing issue. Now, kind of a side comment to all of this is there are many different pricing methodologies. I do not want to get into all of those. We've had previous episodes where we talked about the different pricing methods of per user, per device, risk-based pricing. You should be applying some pricing methodology consistently in your MSP practice so that you can achieve and come to these types of things and tinker with service delivery and pricing adjustments to make sure that you're hitting your margin zone where you want to be, you're delivering your service consistently, and you are protecting your margin. Because if you don't protect your margin, and I know MSPs who don't protect their margins, and they like to say, well, I don't like to say no to my customers, which generally is MSP speak for, I'm going to do a bunch of free stuff and I'm not going to charge the customer for it. Really bad advice for a number of reasons. Bad advice to do that. But if you have a pricing methodology and you stick to it, you're going to be more likely to be price protected, margin protected. It doesn't mean that you don't do that experimentation, but having a methodology that is consistent, it's easy for you to understand and to apply, those will all be really good indicators to me that you have a good handle on your pricing and you are going to be margin and price protected. Hope that helps. If you have any questions, definitely send us an email, give us a comment. I'm particularly interested in what you guys have to think on the PE issue and the sales issue, because I think those are really pervasive issues that we hear a lot about from you guys out there. So I know it's on your mind and it's something you guys think about a lot. So send us a comment or question if you got it. Until next time.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, please give us a like. Make sure you are subscribed to the podcast so you'll get notified when future episodes are released. We will see you next time in the MSP Zone.